This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Whitley Strieber's legendary Dreamland podcast, where the extraordinary is examined, flipped over, shaken like a rag doll, and swept clean of any pocket change. I'm James Falk, monthly Dreamland guest host and regular MC of the Neon Galactic podcast, available wherever podcasts can be found and at youtube.com/@NeonGalactic. If you love this show, Neon Galactic is yet another route into the wild and often transcendental weirdness of the world and wider Wonderverse. We'd love to have you on board. It's an honor, as always, to fill in for Whitley, as much as I can, in exploring the issues and conundrums surrounding UFOs, non-human intelligence, psi phenomenon, human potential, and the nature of the cosmos. Whitley has done tremendous work in helping to lift the dialogue around UFOs and sundry out of the tabloids and into the academy. Our guest today, Adam Curry, has had an enormous impact bridging that same kind of gap. He represents a class of up-and-coming movers and shakers, scientists, researchers, and theorists who are doing the hard and necessary work to continue that evolution and ultimately transform human society. Some have portrayed these conversations about anomalies and consciousness as a battle against science, confusing materialist dogma and debunker diatribes with the elegant and necessary process of experimentation and interpretation that is the scientific method. Adam Curry, along with a quietly building army of intrepid thinkers and doers, aren't so crude. Using the mechanisms of science and technology, they deploy humanity's greatest tool, science, toward the solving of our greatest mysteries. What is the human mind? What is reality? What is consciousness, and is it much more fundamental than we've been led to believe? Is psi phenomena a real thing? Is it an odd genetic anomaly? Or is it universal to all human beings? What does its apparently proven existence say about humans, nature, reality, and time? Perhaps most importantly for the world and this conversation, what concrete steps can be taken now to finally lift these subjects out of myth and story and into the mundane world of decaf lattes and low tire pressure? How do we make it common sense? When that finally occurs, the world will change. What becomes of our education systems, our politics, our personal relationships? What will it mean to be human when magic is suddenly made real? Adam M. Curry is an inventor and tech entrepreneur from Orange County, California. He is a seeker, a scientist, and a trained remote viewer. He has a background in business and has spent more than a decade now researching the mysteries of consciousness and human potential at places like Princeton University's Pear Lab and elsewhere, where his impact has become increasingly dramatic. It's an honor to have you, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for the generous introduction. It's my pleasure to join you.
Hardly generous. You are everywhere these days, and I've been told to interview you countless times because people think that you are the cutting edge of this research. So I deeply appreciate you agreeing to come on the show and have this conversation with me and the audience, of course. I've done a lot of watching and listening and reading about you in recent days, and you have kind of a colorful story for how you initially got into the weirdness and in particular remote viewing early. Can you kind of give us a taste of how that all happened and how you ended up becoming interested in the anomalous?
I think everyone has a kind of unusual origin story when it comes to how they got interested in things like remote viewing and psi phenomena and UAPs. That's probably table stakes. Mine began in the late 90s, early 2000s when I was in high school. And I had met a gentleman who offered me a summer job working for his, at that time, .com company. And my job was to learn to code and become the webmaster. But he had also maintained an abiding interest in remote viewing. And he had a kind of a side business in which he filmed interesting subject matter, things like remote viewing and other types of work. And I had recently read a book about remote viewing, and so I thought it was quite coincidental and synchronistic that this gentleman also was involved in that. And so very quickly, part of my summer job also became going to conferences and filming these talks, many of which were on the subjects, but also as something like an executive remote viewer or a sort of corporate remote viewer. So part of my job was to get really good at remote viewing and be this gentleman's viewer, I guess. So that that involved doing some training with some of the well-known names in the space, and reading a lot of books and just doing a lot of remote viewing. you know, there's multiple doorways through which you can enter the grander world of this stuff. Everything is a rabbit hole, right? So one is through remote viewing, one might be through UAPs, one might be through like more traditional site research. And so very quickly, while the door was remote viewing, it opened me up to what I came to realize was a much broader world of researching the anomalous. And that is what we're talking about, but it's beyond that. There are unexplained but persistent phenomena all around us, and there is a growing community of serious people who find this fascinating, not just fascinating to study, right? But also that can see the benefits and the possibilities for both science and technology by taking these things seriously. And so that kind of became the world in which I sort of grew up. My exposure to science was actually through like professional scientists looking at unexplained phenomena. So what was interesting is I learned both the conventional, you know, standard model theories for a variety of scientific things, but also where they tend to fall down, and where there's a sociological element to science sort of that dictate what is and isn't real, versus always the kind of experimental side of things. And so very quickly, I think that lent a purpose, that gave me a kind of purpose to help as I can try to bring wider awareness to these subject matters that I thought would be very useful for society, and also later on the applications and research side.
Yeah. It's interesting that you got such a first-class education in remote viewing so early. I mean, you're still a teenager, and yet you're introduced to these skills. And I imagine that you discovered their efficacy rather soon. Do you think having such an early introduction was beneficial to your capabilities long-term? And I mean, you know, I'm always looking at the longer-term picture of what we're going to look like as a society as we get more and more into this stuff. I mean, do you think that, you know, educating kids on the reality of this stuff and also the practicality of, you know, using some of these talents would be advantageous to us in the future? Or is there a side where it's detrimental in some way?
It's mostly beneficial.
Yeah.
So it's mostly beneficial because it can give people permission to explore what excites them. And if they really want to improve, for example, their remote viewing abilities, starting early is helpful. Mm-hmm. To the extent that Psi is somehow connected to the brain, the you know, human brain is developing up until about the age of 25. And it's possible that whatever like Psi muscles there may be in the brain are encouraged and developed. It can, I mean, this isn't really true anymore, but it can be a little detrimental in that, it can be so exciting and interesting that it might dissuade somebody from pursuing a more traditional scientific career, as was the case with me. but that's subjective.
It's interesting. I always think of the, you know, sort of the legend in the UAP circles about kids who are taken at a young age as psionic assets or whatever, and and trained up in this regard. And even Whitley has talked a little bit about that kind of thing. But it's never anything that's been, you know, solidly proven at this point. I wonder, you know, at those ages that they're talking about in those stories, it's a lot different than someone who's a teenager going into it voluntarily. Can I ask a little bit about what you were looking at as a remote viewer for this company?
I didn't do a lot for the company, but mostly it was, a little bit was looking at the future of the industry, the future of, you know, where what we were doing was going. I don't know if that was helpful at all. On the side, I did, like for myself, I did sports betting. So I was seeing if I could, view the outcomes of horse races or baseball games. That's one of the first places that are exciting that you go. And I did pretty well. I did like three full trials of 10 outcomes. I think the first 10, I got 10 out of 10 right. And the second, I think I got like 9 out of 10 right or something. So I was pretty good out of the gates. And my usually what happens when you are into Psi is, or you do a remote viewing, the first few times you do it or do anything, your results are really good. And then what happens is it tends to decline.
There's decay over time because of interest
Yeah.
or whatever else, right? Yeah.
It's particularly pronounced in Psi, but I think that it's probably more of a universal phenomena. There's a gentleman named Jonathan Schooler, I think, who's out of UC Santa Barbara or Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara or Santa Cruz, but he's looked at in depth at the decline effect as a broad phenomena across disciplines and found that it's real. So, traditionally we would attribute that to the early experiments were somehow wrong or misleading. And that might be true, but there could also be this psi component on behalf of the experimenters who might be really excited about the first time they try an experiment, get really good results, and then sort of decline. And I experienced some of the decline effect, but that's anticipated, right? And any good trainer will tell you that the first few times you do it, you're going to get good results, and then it will decline. But now the real training kicks in, or now your job is to practice, right? And so then you just kind of like make these slow gains in progress, punctuated by big discoveries that get you to that next plateau and the next plateau and so forth. And and that's kind of what separates somebody who is generally very reliable in terms of their results from I guess tourists in the space, something like that.
Now, the names that you were working with as you were training up were the best, right? I mean, I think I heard you mention Skip Atwater and Joe McGonigal and these guys who have, no?
Lynn Buchanan.
Lynn Buchanan, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, and a few others.
A
Yeah.
few
I knew
others,
those
but those are.
guys. They were often, they're around, but I never did any training or anything with them.
Okay. And are you still a member of the International Remote Viewers Association, or a board member?
Nope. There's a rotating board member, so I was there for a while. But I think I'm still a member. So there's an organization called IRVA, which was founded by what we would consider the organizers or godfathers of remote viewing. And they're still around and active, and they host really, really special conferences. So anyone who's interested in this stuff, I would recommend, checking out IRVA.
Yeah, it's in Nevada, right? I think is the where they hold it. So, I mean, one of the questions, the fundamental questions that it always comes back to are, what are people doing when they're remote viewing? Is it necessary, first of all, to even understand what you're doing, or can it be, used without even that kind of ontological grasp of what's actually occurring? But do you have any sense that at least what you tell yourself of what's happening when you are in the process of trying to view a target?
Yeah, I can give you my take on it.
Okay, yeah.
There's a plurality of opinions about what's going on, but here's my take. Remote viewing is a structured process of getting information from the subconscious mind into the conscious mind. Okay, so along with that perspective, is implied the idea that our subconscious mind is somehow connected to that information field, the quantum field, or the maybe your future self when you get feedback. It is the interface to that still unknown mechanism by which a person's consciousness can retrieve information across time and space. That's the idea. And I'm being intentionally glib and hand waving about that because that's pretty much all we know at this point.
Sure.
And so, you look at any divination technique, you could think of it all in some way as a method to get information from the subconscious up into the conscious. So the theory with remote viewing, which I think is broadly correct, is the interface between the subconscious and the conscious is the body. So this is more obvious, for example, in dowsing, right? Where the dowser is training subtle movements in their hands, which were reflected in the pendulum, And the idea is that the involuntary movements driven by the subconscious show up in the pendulum in a more pronounced way, and the practitioner can develop a language. You know, swinging this way means one thing, swinging another way means something else. But you could go more broadly too. You could look at, for example, tarot cards. Perhaps it's the particular way in which you shuffle the deck, or the particular way in which something causes you to decide to pull that card, right? And in this way, you're getting whatever the subconscious knows about the question at hand up into the conscious mind. So remote viewing is like that, in my opinion. When you start out, you develop your own ideograms. So ideograms are these little movements that you make with a pen or a pencil on paper that are meant to show you in a very basic gestalt kind of way what the target is. So somebody will read off some numbers that represent the target. You're writing down the numbers, and when you're at the last number, you let your hand make any type of motion. So that motion that it makes could be a squiggly line or a jagged line or a circle or something. You've trained to be meaningful to you. So for me, a kind of wave-like line meant water. A head and shoulders looking line meant a human. A straight line that dropped off meant natural world or landscape. I had others for artificial. And so this is where you begin, is this is your kind of karate wax on, wax off stuff. You get really proficient to the point where it becomes second nature, right? And you want it to be second nature because you want to tap into those involuntary movements driven by your subconscious. And the particular line tells you something about the consciousness. Okay. So that's where you start. And then, to put it very simply, the subsequent process from that point is attempting to set aside authentic perceptions from perceptions that are influenced somehow by your conscious mind's attempt to guess what it is. So meditators learn this very clearly. But basically, the conscious mind is always there trying to be helpful. And what it does is it tries to put names and explanations and basically nouns into the signal, right? And that may or may not be correct. But the underlying information that's causing your conscious mind to come up with, you know, to attempt to guess what it is the theory is that is correct and that's true. So, for example, your target might be an apple, like a red apple. Your conscious mind might You might get a flash of something red, but your conscious mind might say, "Oh, I know what it is. It's a fire truck." It's like, "Ah, it's not a fire truck, but it is red." So what you do is you basically put down the adjectives,
The attributes of whatever you're,
the
yeah.
attributes, yeah, and then you set aside the nouns. Okay. And then you just do this a lot and you try to get really good at it. And then generally, the more time you spend doing this, you know, over 45 minutes or an hour in most cases, you start to get a much more, like, you kind of sink in to the perceptions that are coming to you. And then you can do things like produce more detailed drawings or develop more, kind of flesh out the target a little bit. Now, remote viewing probably has the most attention of any of these divination methods, I guess, except for something like tarot. And the reason is it's got a really interesting story with its history with the intelligence agencies. And you know, there's all this kind of like intrigue and so forth around it that is really interesting.
By games.
But yeah, exactly. But even the trainers will tell you that remote viewing was developed to be practical. It doesn't necessarily mean that because you know remote viewing, you're any better at psi than a person of natural talent or average talent, but you're more reliable. So the idea was that you could train up people who could use this in a situation of stress or duress, or maybe they're not even in the zone, right? But your job is to try to produce information, and so you have the remote viewing training to fall back on, right? And that makes it practical and that makes it reliable.
Actionable and repeatable, right? I mean, that's Interesting for several reasons. I've interviewed Bertie Jaworski, also known as Prudence Calabrese, who has been doing this for a long time. And she talks a lot about the sort of unconscious signal and the physicality of the it's like subconscious welling up. And I think it's really interesting how, like, on a certain level, you're meant to trust your body more than your intellect and kind of, hone in on that subconscious signal and bring it to the surface. I love that. And, it's reminds me of the way that the ancients have always thought of the human as a layered spiritual being. Like there's the physical self, and then there's potentially the emotional self, and then the astral self, and you're stacked up with these different layers of being, and then ultimately there's a higher self. And because it sure seems like with what you're describing, there are two personalities vying within us, one that has some sort of transcendent presence and awareness, and then the other is in the material world, and they're kind of like pantomiming to each other, trying to communicate, but that communication is somehow inefficient and hard to translate. Do you ever think about that idea of, that sort of the ancients had with the soul and how it might be a stacked entity and how it relates to the subconscious relationship in remote viewing?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how
I
could you
think
not, right?
most people that contemplate the mystery of the dual nature of both our what seems to be non-physical consciousness and our physical bodies and how the two come together. I mean, that's like the classic problem, right? We've been dealing with this for thousands of years. I would say that the ancient Vedic thinkers had an interesting take. They're real experts on this, but broadly, the way I kind of think about it is through a process of refining their own nervous system and their own sensitivity to ideas, and a process of contemplation about big questions, they developed the science of the subjective. That is to say, that they became so sensitive to the way in which our subconscious mind, our body, and our conscious mind come together, that they were able to describe it in remarkable detail and like through this heuristic create a unique organizing chart, if you will, of the levels of self. And they have levels of self in the human body, like they've got like the food body, and they've got the where it's things that you've just eaten, and where that becomes more integrated into your physical body, and then where that becomes your actual physical body that we talk about. And then they say that there's an energetic body as well attendant to that. We might think of that as the electric field or the electric qualities of the human body. Our skin has something like 40 microvolts. There's this electric component that we're becoming aware of in the mainstream. Beyond that, there's like this other kind of etheric body, and then they go beyond that, sort of into realms in which are mostly speculative to us, although people that have unusual experiences or that contemplate how remote viewing or something could work would describe this. Like Bob and Rose out of body stories, for example, talk about him leaving his body and traveling around his bedroom or around the city. And it looks like his bedroom and it looks like a city, but it's somehow not. It's somehow some level above or some like semi-dimensional level or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Like each body has a world kind of as that's associated with it, like the astral world and the Buddhic
Right.
realm, and yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, I have no way of indicating whether or not that's true. The Vedics, though, also, they thought a lot about the physical world down at the level of the invisible, maybe kind of like the Greeks, where they didn't have the benefits of electron microscopes and these types of things. But by becoming aware of the as above, so below principle and looking at these sort of processes in the world that they could see, they were able to, in many cases, approximate, be directionally correct about what the microscopic world looked like, and the Vedics were no different. So it wasn't entirely a science of just the subjective, but they used subjective tools and reason to formulate a directionally correct description of what we're learning about the unseen worlds. Things like quantum particles and behaviors and that kind of stuff.
found insights for people who didn't have an actual glimpse into that material, and did it through a self-examination that we've kind of totally forgotten about as a culture. And maybe we'll start to regain now that this stuff is becoming more topical, but we'll see.
I expect so. I think that they, it, you know, from the point of view of the last 100 years or so, maybe the last 200 years, it seemed as though we were moving away from the ancient traditions and becoming more rational and sophisticated. And we were, but only in a narrow sense, right? And as this materialistic, strictly material reductionist framework is as showing its inability, its anemia at explaining things like the nature of consciousness. And now that's certainly not controversial to say that anymore. There's a renewed appreciation for the perspectives that come from the ancients. I expect that to continue, and that as time goes on, we'll find that they actually knew more and more about, fundamentally about the nature of reality and consciousness than we may have recently expected.
So we'll take a break real quick. We'll come back and talk a little bit about your scientific investigation of psi. And there's some really fascinating experiments that I want to ask you about. So let's take a break real quick. So you were doing your remote viewing work, and then you ultimately went back to school. I understand that there was an earthquake predicting kind of machine and experiment that you masterminded in there somewhere. But how did you ultimately end up doing a parapsychological and consciousness research? Was it largely just taking what you had learned from remote viewing and, you want to kind of like explain that? Is that what the motivation was, or?
Well, when I was a senior in high school, I had met a kind of a mentor guy. He was a really interesting figure, and he had been giving me papers to read. A lot of this were names that are emerging now again, like Thomas Townsend Brown, and others who were kind of looking at the connections between gravity and electromagnetism. And there was one body of research that was looking at how analog electronic equipment, like capacitors, for example, capacitors measured in terms of its dielectric constant, which is its ability to hold a charge. And there was one set of papers that were describing how that dielectric constant could change according to the movements of solar bodies, right? So I thought, well, maybe there's dimensions of gravitation or dimensions of something out there. Maybe it's not gravity that are affecting these devices. So I don't know. I set up this experiment and had these capacitors that were, I was just amplifying them and recording data over a long period of time. And I was looking at those deviations compared to seismicity on the planet. And actually found some interesting correlations there that were a bit unexplained. And so this became my high school science fair project.
Which
And
is mind blowing. I mean, that's so subtle and like technically, anyway, that's amazing for a high schooler, obviously.
yeah, I said probably didn't have enough friends or something.
The benefits of isolation, right?
The benefits of isolation, yeah. Which I guess when you grow up in rural Colorado, it's easy to have those benefits of isolation. So, I think probably just because it was a good technical project and the results were interesting, and this project ended up doing very well, and at the International Science Fair level. And so rather than go off to college, I decided to take a year and to try to pursue this. Like, can we build, for example, a new kind of a new method of earthquake forecasting that might be beneficial? And so that involved me refining the circuitry and trying in earnest to build something like a network, like a global network of these devices that had to be kind of plugged into power or plugged into a computer. And if I could get enough of these around the world, then we might get something like a dynamic signal. It's not a lot of earthquake activity in Colorado, but you put them in the right places and you might be able to learn something new. And so I worked with, there were a lot of people that were willing to help. And I also began to go present this work at scientific conferences, one of which was a group called the Society for Scientific Exploration, or SSE. They've been around since, I think, 1980, and it was founded by a lot of names that are, again, emerging these days. Peter Sturrock, who is an astrophysics professor, Robert John, who is the dean of the engineering school at Princeton and created the Paralab and did a lot of the sci work, and had many of the original remote viewer people, removing people involved, people like Jessica Utz, who's this like world-class statistician who did a lot of the stats
Really?
work on the remote viewing program. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And basically a secret gold mine of intellectual treasures, wonderful, wonderful people who are all very accomplished in their own fields, but that were hip to the fact that there's a lot more going on in the psi dimensions and all these other things. And so the SSE anyway was created to be a forum for the critical discussion of each other's work, right? There was a bias. It's still there. It's not as much, but there was back then a bias towards publishing your results in peer-reviewed journals, not on the basis of the quality of the scholarship, but on the basis of the subject matter. And so they ended up having to create their own organization to collaborate and provide, critical feedback on work. And so anyway, they have these meetings every year. I went to one of them in Charlottesville to talk about my electrogravitic gravity prediction work. And it was there that I met Bob and Brenda. So Bob John and Brenda Dunn were the founder and the lab manager of a topology laboratory running out of the engineering center at Princeton University. And this lab had been established in 1979 by Bob while he was dean, in order to attempt to explore in an extremely rigorous way the nature of consciousness, and its relationship to reality, to physical reality, which he, I think, correctly saw as a fundamental engineering question. As like the leading mind or one of the leading minds in engineering, you want to know something about how mind and matter come together, right?
Yeah.
He had been an advisor on a graduate student's project, looking at that was designed to build a random number generator and was looking to see if a person's intention or awareness could influence the output. He had no reason to think that was possible whatsoever, but he liked the ambitious nature of the project and thought anyway it would be a good technical project, so he agreed to be the advisor to this. Anyway, it turned out that the random number generator that this undergraduate had built was showing statistically significant results that seemed to correlate with the pre-stated operator intention, meaning there was some kind of relationship between mind and matter here that Bob couldn't explain.
Yeah.
So he founded this laboratory in the basement of the engineering quad and arranged private financing for it and brought together a team of really wonderful world-class people ranging from experimental psychologists like Roger Nelson, who went on to start the Global Consciousness Project, and astrophysicists and the usual, cadre of intelligent people. And Brenda was the laboratory manager. She had independently been doing work at, I think, the University of Chicago. She was a psychologist. And anyway, they began a multi-decade effort to explore consciousness through the use of random number generators or random systems in general, and as well to continue their remote viewing work, which they called remote perception, but it's the same thing. And that's the experimental side, and also to develop, to attempt to develop frameworks for understanding this, either the mechanism or something more broad than the mechanism. So I met them. I met these two guys at the SSE conference, and they sort of took me under their wing, and they became very, very close friends and mentors, and I call them my fairy godparents. Brenda, in particular, the whole lab was like this, but Brenda, in particular, was very good at finding young people and getting them involved in this work. So I would spend my summers there basically, and I was just an intern, I was just helping with experiments. But around 2007, 2006, there were a couple people like me who had been just as involved, more involved really, with the Pear Lab, who decided that the next phase for this research was probably not publishing just another paper, but to try to, if you will, I don't use this word, but like democratize the research, meaning make the hardware, the random number generator hardware, more available to other laboratories in order for them to do their own work.
Yeah, it does seem ideally suited for that kind of experimentation, right? I mean, because very subtle effects in a very mysterious way are what get manifested when people are apparently exercising their intention, and it seems like ideally set up and the perfect solution for trying to find very minute effects. I mean, from a layman's standpoint, anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
The laboratory was such a fun place to hang out, because it had many experimental setups that had been created over the years that were kind of random. So one was like a fountain that would spray water in a straight line upwards, and then it would measure how the water was falling. And the idea is that, maybe a person could influence the water more. There were like robots, like we had these like little robots thing that would move around a table. We had what we called a random mechanical cascade, which is kind of like an advanced Plinko machine that would dump these balls down, 9,000 plastic balls down a series of pegs, and there'd be a normal distribution at the bottom. And somebody was whose job it was to sit on a sofa, stare at this thing, and try to mean shift it one way or another. It was great. It was totally playful. And all those things are awesome, but the electronic random number generators were and are the best method of looking for psi effects, because they take advantage of quantum phenomena that give you a good random baseline. So more or less, these machines all work by exploiting some sort of intrinsically random physical phenomena at the quantum scale that's converted into ones or zeros, right? So that gives you a good baseline of 50-50 ones and zeros, and then that makes the experiments easy and reliable. A person's job is
Radio,
to try to push that 50-50 one way or another.
yeah, like
So,
radioactive decay or something like that, right? I mean,
exactly,
or
yeah.
yeah.
And that equipment, although probably the best for it, is very expensive, or it was very expensive. The radioactive decay random number generator that is being used was like 200 grand. So, not the kind of thing that an amateur experimenter, or even many labs, except for the very well-funded ones, can afford. And so this group of people created a company called Siluron, which I joined. And Siluron's purpose in the beginning was to develop low-cost electronic random number generator equipment that was, very robust, and had as well a software suite that made the collection of data easier,
Yeah.
right? So it's basically like this toolkit for advancing psi research. And so this would have been 2006 to, I guess, to present, but we were really active in from 2006 through when the lab closed. The Pear Lab closed in 2007. And then when we finished college around 2008, we all came together and we had this basically psi startup in Princeton with myself and a few other people and some of the original Pear Lab founders. And we spent a couple of years, some of the funnest years of my life actually, developing not just research tools, but also consumer products that were psionic, like the first psionic consumer products. So one of those was what we called the mind lamp. And the mind lamp was a glowing desk light that had a random number generator in it. So the idea was that you could explore the influence of your own intentions through the mind lamp, and you'd like pick a color, say, think blue, and you would just think blue at the lamp, and then it would turn blue or turn red or whatever. And it was this, rather than looking
Wow.
at the, a line moving up and down on a computer screen, it was a more interesting form of feedback. And
Yeah,
so that was really
absolutely.
popular, and we created a number of really fun, tools that could allow people to explore this stuff. And we also had this kind of research side to it. Around that time, near the end of that, or near I guess 2020, 2011, I had been paying attention to mobile apps, obviously, which were, the 2010, 2011, 2012 is when mobile apps were really kicking off. And we did a project to develop a random number generator mobile app. And so the idea was to create something like a global consciousness project, but on a mobile phone. And so we did that, and it was successful. And a number of us at Siluron decided that we're a little too early with this stuff, and that we were going to go and we're going to keep Siluron going, but we're going to go, not have too much of an opportunity cost, I guess.
Yeah.
So from there, I moved out to San Francisco and I became a technology entrepreneur. And then I, at around 2014, I started to become more serious about creating some sort of app-based Psi research project, which ultimately became Entangled.
Fantastic. Can I ask you about a particular experiment that I think just absolutely blows my mind? You talked about it on a documentary. You called it the plant RNG experiment, where there was, I mean, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, can you explain what it, because if that is actually true, there is something beyond a human intention that is affecting the generation of random numbers to the, I mean, it just ontologically kind of melts all the categories, right? Like, yeah, can you explain it for us?
Okay, so what you said is maybe true. It might be that there are but okay, I'll explain the experiment
I
and
get
I'll tell you why.
excited.
It's a good one. Okay, so the idea is, sure, humans seem to be able to influence random number generators, but what about non-humans? So the laboratory, some people at the lab basically put together what they called plant reg, plant random event generator. And this was a darkened room. And in the darkened room, in the center of it, was a growing light that was hanging from the ceiling. The light had the ability to shine into one of the four corners. And it's the corner in which it shone was controlled by one of these random number generators. So that the time that it was shining in any one corner was totally random and unpredictable. Then you took a house plant that needed the light to survive, and you put it in one of those four corners. And over time, you examine how often it's shining in one corner versus all the other corners. Now, there should be a 25%, approximately 25% of the time the light is shining in one of those corners. What they found was that it was shining more often on the plant, like more often than it should on the plant. So, like one explanation for that is that plants being alive have some level of consciousness, and that consciousness seems to be bending reality to help it live. In other words, I mean, prosaically, maybe the plant affected the random number generator to make it shine more on itself. I'm partly sympathetic to that perspective, because I do believe that consciousness by its nature this is what it does. It is something that, through an unknown mechanism, is able to influence the probabilities of the physical world in order to bring to it what it needs for its survival and growth. That just seems like a logical thing to state, right?
Yeah.
However, there's an alternative and beguiling counter explanation, which is that it's an experimenter effect. That is to say that the people that set up the experiment wanted it to work. And it was their subconscious that was affecting the behavior of the random number generator. Remember when we were talking at the top of the hour about how the first few times you do anything, you get good results?
Yeah.
Well, the first time you set up a plant experiment that might be showing some capabilities of life beyond what you might expect that have every reason to probably be real, might actually be the level of excitement and belief necessary to drive the effect subconsciously.
Gotcha.
It's really difficult to get around experimenter effects, psi experimenter effects in any experiment. I have even wilder versions of that story, but that's the plant experiment. And so, you know, my explanation for what that is it's like, it's both and. It is perhaps a really good experimenter effect, but also, you know, it could be that the plant itself is just doing what all life does, which is at some level influencing the world to, you know, bending reality around it to get what it needs.
There's an interesting point there where there's been a lot of discussion around the timelines of evolution and whether there's been enough time for, you know, evolution to occur to the complexity it has, without some kind of teleological, or, you know, people talk about God's will or whatever. But this would provide a mechanism for life to kind of succor itself forward through, you know, psi effects. I think that that's really interesting and compelling idea. How do you isolate away from those experimenter effects? Is there anything you can do? I mean, it's almost as if you had a computer set up an experiment and perform the experiment without any human involvement. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's a role for AI in the future. How do you know?
Boy. So there's, you know, two parts to that. I think you're so right about your interpretation of plant RNG. If that's true, we now have a way to think differently about prosaic evolution.
Yeah.
So currently, you kind of have these two options, right? Everything's a happy accident, including life as an evolution based on beneficial mutations or something like that. And while I have no problem necessarily believing that the numbers can be a little difficult, right? So you look at how fine-tuned the universe and its constants are to life, and how many millennia you would have to get to be at the level of dimorphism on the planet is, it's like borderline preposterous. I'm not an expert in this, but, you know, some people think that it doesn't really fit with the age of the Earth as we know it. Okay. So then that's one version of how do you explain life on Earth. And another one is a pure creator, right? It was all. So I think there's a lot of people have problems with like being overly indexed on one or overly indexed on the other. But if consciousness is this kind of more fundamental, if you will, kind of non-physical principle or organizing principle in the universe, then it could be that you can resolve, and if I'm sure you can resolve the types of time paradoxes necessary to account for the dimorphism of life and its various expressions through time. In other words, that mind matter consciousness effect, that psi effect of all life, might be the thing that's teleologically guiding its evolution, not random chance, or at least not just random chance.
One of the questions that seems to always come up and that I'm always wondering about is that You mentioned Jessica Utz, and she was the head of the American Statistical Association, I believe, if that's the right name for it. And she at one point was quoted saying, if psi was any other science, it would be accepted as proven by now, because the numbers through meta-analysis and other tools are just through the roof in terms of odds against chance for all of these things to have occurred. What is it going to take for psi to be accepted as a reality? Is there going to be any one experiment that's going to suddenly knock things loose? Or is it the discovery of the mechanism that makes it all possible? Is that the missing piece? Will AI help? How do we get there? Because it seems like that is a very important milestone to get to in order to open ourselves up to a whole different consideration of how we should be interacting with one another and the planet.
A very good question. I suppose my perspective on that is that the mechanism is the final domino. But if that mechanism were to, like, you basically can't have that. No one would pay attention to the mechanism if an insufficient number of people believed that it needed to be answered.
Right.
So what that means is that you need to go through decades of a highly rigorous peer-reviewed, meta-analysis kind of studies, through a trial by fire, right, that Jessica Utz discusses, in order to have a background canonical, empirical base on which to think about consciousness differently. Okay, well, we have that. So I don't necessarily think that one more
Experiment is going to make the difference, right?
one more experiment is going to make the difference. Although, man, there's some really good stuff coming out. And unless that experiment is like pointing to something like a mechanism, and then you're going to need to have an environment where more talent feels like it's okay enough to come out and explore these ideas professionally. Through the decades, there have been very significant, there's been a lot of talent and a lot of like very, very serious qualified people looking at these types of things privately, right? Why privately? It's because they felt like their tenure would be at risk, or
Stigma,
they
right? I
were,
mean,
fear of what other people think. So then you needed to have this kind of, cultural shift, in these directions that made it okay to do these. And so I think we're having that now, thanks to what you're doing and what many others are doing. And indeed, there are a lot of very interesting folks who are coming out and saying, yes, this stuff is real. I've been interested in it for a long time, and the data is compelling. And then I suppose that the final thing is the mechanism, and that's no small feat, right? It might be the thing that takes the longest time. It depends on what it ends up being. So, if there is an update to the standard model of physics somehow that recovers the history of psi by providing a mechanism, it might not take as long. But if we're really at the transition point between one set of fundamental first prin metaphysical first principles about how we see the universe, then it might take longer.
Yeah.
I can point to maybe like three of those that have happened in the last 300 years. So I actually kind of think we're on that precipice, but I don't. I guess the question is, do we need to move into a post-materialist metaphysical framework as a first principle, or can we stay somewhat rooted in the current pseudo metaphysicalist perspective, and come up with the theory that provides the mechanism that recovers historical psi. One possible example for that would be, I think they tried with the double slit interpretation. So there's one perspective in quantum mechanics where consciousness collapses the wave function, and like that is
Copenhagen
that. The,
interpretation,
yeah,
yeah.
it's like a that's a my opinion on that one. Again, I'm not a quantum physicist, but my opinion on that one is it's like this good story, but it's difficult to actually make it work. It's not clear that there's information transfer that on the level that you would need for psi to happen. talk to other people like Dean Radin, et cetera, about what they think. I think you'd get a more robust opinion about that. And there's also perhaps reasons to think that collapse can happen in other ways now, not necessarily through conscious observers. But that doesn't mean that Psi isn't real. It's just that that is maybe not the breakthrough. One that I'm fond of pointing to is Hameroff and Penrose's ORC-OR model.
Yeah, I had him on
And
the show recently, actually, not that long ago. Stuart Hameroff.
Stuart Hameroff,
Yeah.
what a guy.
Oh, he's a guy. Fun conversation. Absolutely brilliant. But yeah.
Yeah, he's cool. For those who may not be familiar,
Please, yeah.
Hameroff's an anesthesiologist. Penrose is a Nobel laureate physicist, like central casting, British accent, like arm patches on the elbows, jacket, like lovely, lovely gentleman. And they have this theory called ORC-OR, orchestrated objective reduction. And it basically suggests that every cell has these structures called microtubules, right? And the function of the microtubules are more than just the structural integrity of the cell, but that these tubes, these like hollow tubes, are just so that a room temperature quantum, I guess, entanglement or quantum uncertainty can persist in them. And that a moment of consciousness is the collapse of these probabilities within the microtubules. So, and they kind of came to this theory in part because of the mystery of anesthesia itself. Like, we don't know why anesthesia works. We just know that if you give the right chemicals, the right mixture, that the lights go out temporarily, but you're still alive, right? So your awareness goes away, but you're still alive. And so they were thinking that the anesthesia chemical might be attenuating the behavior of the microtubules, and therefore the microtubules are involved in conscious awareness. And from there, it kind of has evolved into a more half experimental, half speculative kind of picture of how the microtubules are involved. Anyway, the point of that is, if that work, keeps developing in a positive way, you might have a physicalist, sort of materialist, way of explaining psi, because of the density of microtubules in a brain and the ability for those microtubules to communicate through entanglement with the rest of the fabric of the universe that may or may not contain some information that we call psi. You might have a potential explanation there without having to do a clean reset, I guess, on the underlying metaphysical models of reality.
It's interesting. It's like you're basically saying, do we need a full-fledged Copernican revolution, or can we settle for something just shy of that that will accommodate the phenomenology of psi, right? I mean, and that's an interesting question.
I don't know the answer, but then that's where you start to factor in like the UAP stuff, and because it's not the only mystery out there that we're currently grappling with. And you put all those together, and you might actually be more in a Copernican revolution space versus a software update.
That was my next question, actually, was would an APA, would a UAP revelation and its relationship to consciousness ultimately potentially move this conversation that much forward? I mean, I guess it would be dependent on how they were linked and how that was demonstrated, but I could see a world where the momentum changes, you know.
I think there's no doubt that it would push ahead, in particular, psi research for a number of reasons. One is the things that you thought you knew weren't exactly true. And also, of course, there's the question about how are these UAP moving around space? Because they don't seem to be using standard model principles, at least as we understand them presently. And so that pretty much requires you to make a meaningful update or refresh of the standard model. And it could be in doing that that you also get whatever it is that provides the mechanism or recovers the historical psi data.
Let's take another break real quick. I have a bunch more questions about UAP, like we were just talking about. And then also, I really want to get into how the world changes if Psi gets accepted as real. It seems like there might be some cultural adjustments that have to get made if we begin to exploit those talents. So we'll be right back. So the million-dollar question to me is, I read a lot of science fiction, I read a lot of fantasy. There's all these worlds that get concocted where people have strange superpowers and they have to, adapt to live in that kind of environment. So what does the future human look like if we begin to realize that Psi is real? And not only that, but potentially get into a Psi kind of, arms race, a technological age where, we see both technology and Psi, racing forward. What do your thoughts lead you when you think of Psi as an accepted fact of life and where we'll end up?
Well, it won't be a panacea to all our problems, but I think the world gets a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can riff a little on that. I
Please.
think one thing that you would see is the emergence of people with the emergence of naturals, people with natural talent. If Psi becomes broadly accepted and known about, of course, the next question is, how psychic am I? Like, do I have these powers? And people will try, more people will try Psi tasks than ever before, and some of them will be damn good. And so these folks will emerge as natural talent, and there'll probably be a place for them in society as people that can. I guess, you might go visit an intuitive for guidance today, but you'll probably be going to, you probably have more options, and you'll have there might even be like a standardized, this is a project we should do actually. There could even be like a standardized Psi test, kind of like a vocational like capabilities,
Aptitude
like
test
a
or
certificate.
whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like if you're an IT specialist, you know, it's like certificates that shows, you know what you're doing. The same could be true with Psi. I would expect a lot of corporate interest in leaning on intuitive individuals to provide some guidance. Obviously, the way that it probably provides a bit more of a shield for one's personal reality, for better or for worse. In other words, as Psi as a or as a proactive role in reality creation, can be used to explain in a good way or a bad way a person's behavior. So you might have like a lot of that going on. It probably accelerates the investigation of a lot of these things. We begin the process of updating our frameworks for how we understand this stuff. I mean, you could go on from there. What I'm doing with Entangled is kind of interesting. So, and it's topical actually to your question. So Entangled is it's a mobile app that you download and you get a single photon bit, like a quantum bit that's generated for you once per second. So everyone is generating all these photon bits. And then we have these questions about the future, like kind of these prediction questions that we pose to each user. And then we analyze the data and produce an answer or a prediction. And the theory is that when you get a push notification about some event or some prediction that was made, that kind of closes the causal loop. So an individual's subconscious mind knows that in the future, they're getting a push notification about an earthquake that happened or an earthquake that got predicted. So in the present, their subconscious mind can influence the photon bits in the now in a way that tells the system, like registers as a prediction on the system, and then eventually closes the time loop with the push notification. Kind of sci-fi, right?
Yeah,
It's a
absolutely.
wild, crazy project, but I'm having a
Yeah.
lot of fun with it. And so, but I and the results have been very interesting. So my answer to that question is, I believe that we can use in a world where psi becomes more accepted, I guess, we can use psi to accelerate the process of scientific discovery and to accelerate the ability to provide answers to questions for people in a way that AI can't. You think of AI as this like supercomputer, it's amazing, it can do all these things for you. All that is true, but there's some things that are just beyond the scope of AI. I don't care how much training or super, like, quantum computing or whatever you throw at it. It can't predict the future if it doesn't have an underlying training data. It's algorithmically deterministic in terms of what its answer is, right? But then contrast that with consciousness, which seems to have this ability to access information across time and space, right? So could you build something like a consciousness supercomputer, or a network of subconscious, a network of people that are lending their subconscious minds to solve problems that either AI can't solve, or that AI is not being pointed at to solve. So earthquake prediction is one we're running right now. But there's all kinds of other things that would help speed up, for example, medical discoveries, and other types of breakthroughs just by people kind of psionically providing some sort of input to the system. So, that's one version of where this all goes. I think we get, more of that. I'm trying to,
Fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating.
it's wild, right? When the internet was getting made, I guess, people had been connecting their computers to each other and sending information for a long time before the internet, right? But it wasn't until there was a standardized protocol by which information could be sent to computers that you could build something like the internet. Right. So that protocol was the TCP/IP protocol, and it standardized how packets of information are sent back and forth. Now you could get any computer anywhere in the world, so long as it could connect to the phone network to send information back and forth. So it could be that, and kind of like my forward bet here is that by developing a standard protocol by which you could tap into psi information or tap into, I guess psi information. Now you make it, you open up a world of new possibilities when it comes to actually making this stuff useful and beneficial for the world.
It's going to be a revolution and a revelation all wrapped up in one, and I can't wait to see that occur. Well, that's it for the public version of the Dreamland podcast. For Unknown Country Dreamland subscribers, we'll be right back to dive deeper into the question of plasma, UAP, and how they both seem to converge around the human mind, where it connects to soul. We'll be right back. I believe I heard you quoted somewhere as saying that plasma is a kind of liminal substance, which I thought was an interesting way to put it. And I've been doing a lot of reading recently. There's a book Robert Temple wrote called The New Science of Heaven, where he talks a lot about plasma and its relationship to consciousness and the potential for there to be basically sort of dispersed intelligences made up of dusty cosmic plasmas that have structure and exchange information, much like the human brain does, with neurons and everything else. So I find that deeply fascinating. And I was recently reading in Dean Radin's new book, The Science of Magic: How the Mind Weaves the Fabric of Reality, about experiments that were done with one of those plasma balls, where you touch the edges of the glass and it follows your hand. And apparently, the plasma is really, really highly reactive with the psi effects. And they were able to prove this in various experiments. I'm first of all just kind of fishing to hear what you might have to say about plasmas and your thought on how they may play a role in some of this and how that might be manifested in the physical universe, both as potentially UAP. I mean, there's the Condon report in Britain that talked all about plasmas as potentially a source for UAPs in the sky. But then also you were mentioning earlier the sort of electrophysical relationship that humans have with their aura or whatever you want to call it, sort of a biofield. Could that potentially be a vector for what we consider the human soul? I have just a lot of questions and wondered what your thoughts are.
Plasma is 99% of the universe, right? So for people that don't know, plasma is the fourth state of matter, right? So as you have matter and you add more energy, you get the different levels. So you take water, the lowest level state, you've got ice, add a little more energy, you've got water, add a little more, you have steam. So the same is kind of true. Keep going in sort of gaseous states by adding energy and you get plasma. Most people know it through either lightning or through the plasma balls. And there's a lot more there though. I like you recommend Robert Temple's book, New Science of Heaven. It's a beautiful book. It's elegantly
It is.
written.
He's just he has a way of electrifying the reader with his own enthusiasm for the subject that is just adorable. Anyway, he's brilliant.
Highly recommended. I have been aware of psi research with plasma for a long time. I know Dean has done experiments with this, like going way back, actually. And at least most of them had really good results. The challenge with plasma with psi has been getting a good baseline. So plasma is a chaotic kind of system. Like you want randomness, you want physical randomness when you're doing psychokinetic mind matter interaction stuff, but you also want it to be providing a good baseline. And it's hard to do in a sort of three-dimensional globe where the sparks are flying all over the place. There's a guy named Hale Brownlee who developed an interesting method where he trained a camera on a plasma ball and divided the plasma ball into quadrants, and then was reading the pixel behavior from the camera. And I thought that was a really clever way to do it. There are other ways, but I think the instinct there is, if you're satisfied that psi is real, then maybe the next phase is not just your proving stage, but rather your exploration stage now, right? So are there substances or forms of matter or methods that may not be, shall we say, quite as rigorous as quantum random number generators, but still rigorous enough to reliably show an effect and maybe even get better effects? So one of those is plasma, and you could think, well, if most of the universe is plasma and plasma has all of these strange and beautiful characteristics, and it's a little bit more alive than photons or electrons, at least our human intuition is that it looks and acts a little bit more alive than, these quantum particles that we've been using, then perhaps it might be a better assay of psi effects. And so far, it seems like that is correct. Now, remember to discount what I said about the first few times you do an experiment, right? Anomalies accumulate around meaningfulness in an experiment. And so if you're excited by something and it's meaningful, just be aware that these types of things can happen. But if it persists as, better than the classic psi experiments, I think we're really onto something. And then you can back into why that might be. Could it be the fluid chaotic state of plasma that lends itself to seeing this better, like an ex for example, sort of a butterfly effect where small influences in a chaotic fluid state lead to big changes in the plasma. Like that could be one explanation. I've done an experiment with water a couple of times, looking at the ability of water's impedance to change under the influence of intention, also with very good results. And the thinking there was, well, our bodies are mostly water. Biology, which is attendant to consciousness, is mostly water typically. So maybe there's something special about water that allows the psi effects to show up. And I actually have got better effects with water than I have with anything else. But there's this other side of the plasma that I think connects to the UAPs that maybe make it a perhaps more interesting candidate. You mentioned that, I think in a documentary, maybe it's like 3 or 4 years ago now, I said, look out for a couple of things, right? I Casimir effect, torsion math, like torsion mechanics, plasma, and an emergence of a new thing, the reemergence of ether under a new name of the ether. And the reason I called out plasma was because plasma seems to be a liminal thing, meaning it exists between two other things. So the word subliminal is that space between the unconscious and the conscious mind. So that's subliminal, right? And I believe the plasma is something similar. That is to say that it's kind of an in-between state between the physical world that we see and something else. Maybe extra dimensional. Okay. Why would I say that? Well, there's a number of experimental reasons why I say that. There's a lab that I'm associated with that's looking at the use of plasma to reform matter. And just for like, relatively prosaic industrial applications, but it absolutely works. But if you look at the video footage of the UAPs, they behave quite strangely, right? They may begin as a kind of light in the sky, and as they come into the I don't know, as they become visible, I guess, the colors often will ripple through a cascade of shapes and colors that look a lot like plasma, right? So you got greens and purples and then there's a phase of the UAPs that seem like more solid, I guess. So it could be that if these things are doing some sort of wild interdimensional travel that we've yet to figure out, that they have both a physical state and an interdimensional like travel state, and the in between has a kind of plasma phase to it. Now, I'm not saying that the craft are plasma, not necessarily. It could be that these things have some sort of the way that they work, make an effect of that is what we call plasma that we can see with our own eyes. So I'm not saying that they are plasma, but there very well could be some sort of like plasma component to them. I think it's popular now to refer to weird lights like Earth lights and things that are seen in CE5 expeditions as plasmoids. And I believe that the instinct for that is A, they look like plasma, right? But B, as a moid, it's assigning a kind of proto life to them, or an element of sentience or awareness, or like some modicum of livingness to them. And so it could be too that plasma could be arranged in a state that makes it a new form of life, right? We're used to thinking of life, I guess, in terms of carbon-based, right, or biological, but there could be other arrangements of matter that allow some degree of consciousness or livingness to come through them. And we might be seeing that with the plasma. And maybe that's why in sort of CE5 expeditions, these lights seem to interact with you somehow. That's a bit inexplicable.
And it also occurred to me that when you were saying that, that there may be an efficiency between psi and plasma, that there may be a reactive sort of element with the psi that we're seeing in the skies and what we're, perceiving, like somehow not necessarily a projection, but that there is a relationship that occurs between the mind that's viewing and the plasma in the sky that may be determinative of its behavior. It's a lot of
Yeah,
words
totally.
to say a
You could
simple
have
thing,
a psi
but
effect with plasmic like things in the sky or something like that. There's also some people that think that there are basically like the sky is kind of like the ocean, I guess. There are all these kinds of life forms in the ocean. Maybe there's plasmic type life forms in the sky as well, and what you're seeing is something like that.
That's pretty much all I had for you. That's we're at time, and I thank you for a fantastic, fascinating conversation. I think we went places, so that's always good.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you, and I'll be following your work. Thank you. I'll send you a link when we get done, but Godspeed on all your efforts, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Quickly Strieber, your host for Dreamland.